a professor, you know, for instance, asking an Israeli student, how many Palestinians have you killed in front of the whole class?
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidi.
My guest today is a filmmaker, entrepreneur, activist, contributor to The Sun, and a close friend of mine.
Mother.
A mother, a daughter, a wife, a sibling, and a close friend of mine. I want to put that in there. So here I am with Daniela Kahana.
It's so nice to be here. Thank you, Shai.
It's, you know what? It's so, so nice to have every opportunity to meet. And we've done Shabbat dinners together. We've been to your place many times. But there's something about you. You come into the room and you light up the room. And some people are listening. And I can't even describe what it is other than go on the YouTube, go on Instagram and see Daniela. There's something about you. You're positive. Which I don't understand, and we will get to that. Daniela, I start every episode in the same way, and I'm going to ask you, Daniela Kahana, what kind of a Jew are you?
Well, you're already making me cry, so that's great. And I think that's one of the labels. I don't know. I've been thinking about this question because I know enough to know that you ask this question of every guest you have.
And by the way, this is interesting. Not every guest knows that, and even though we're in season 3, meaning that you are a meticulous, do your homework kind of Jew.
A last minute, do your homework type of Jew. Yes, that's true. And I thought a lot about it, and I think that, you know, on the one hand, of course, I could throw out multiple adjectives. I'm committed. I'm deeply spiritual. I'm open-hearted. I'm learned to some degree. I'm, you know, proud. There's so many adjectives I could kind of fill in the blank with, but I think it's really hard to put a label on it because I think, like most humans, I don't really fit into any one neat box. And I certainly have a hard time kind of choosing the one. So maybe I'll say multifaceted.
You're a multifaceted Jew.
Yeah. On this, though, you know, it's funny because I was talking to my father on the way over here, and you met my dad, and he's just incredible. And, like, talk about somebody who is constantly growing in his Judaism and in his learning. He's getting a PhD in Talmud right now, and, you know, on top of his professional career. And he was talking, and I said, kind of jokingly, I'm going to have to answer this question. And he said, well, you know, Yossi Klein Halevi talks about this too, the paradigm of the Passover Jew versus the Purim Jew. Have you heard about this?
No.
So the Passover Jew is, you could see it kind of from the point of view of, this is the Jew who is deeply empathetic to the suffering of others. And then there's the Purim Jew, who is kind of very concerned about the threat coming towards the Jewish people. That's one paradigm. You could also
see the Hanukkah Jew that's concerned about calories, but, you know, okay.
Exactly. I mean, you could also see it as like the Passover Jew, the Jew that kind of sits back and waits for God or, you know, for the Savior to kind of come and redeem, the passive Jew. And then the Purim Jew is the one that, you know, proactively engages politically where God is not even mentioned in the story. So there's all these kind of different paradigms that I find so interesting about Jewish history and kind of the types of Jews out there. But ultimately, I think we're always like a mixture of both. And it's that balance and that duality that we need to kind of really be our best.
That is a very, very interesting thing that you just said, because I didn't think you would go there. The Purim story, most Jews are invisible. They didn't do anything. They waited to die. And luckily were saved by two Jews, Esther and Mordechai. The Passover Jew, yeah. They were, let's pack up and leave. Every Jew did something. Yes, they heeded Moses and Aaron's call. But at the end of the day, every Jew had to pack up and make their own decision.
Yeah, when given the instructive.
I
mean, keep in mind the context of that was they had just seen God perform these incredible, supernatural, you know, seemingly miracles. I think with the Purim story, yeah, you had a case of like real powerlessness where there was this sense of we don't have any agency. And obviously, as we've seen through history, that is incredibly like the, you know, the phrase power corrupts, but powerlessness also corrupts, something like that. I might be butchering it. And I think, you know, as the Jewish story goes, powerlessness is worse than having power. And then having power is just once you have power, it's, well, how do you engage with that in a you know, fair, righteous way?
You know, when we think about power, we think about violence. We can think about physical power. You're probably very strong, but you're not a big, you know, muscular person. It's not visibly. But you are very powerful.
Thank you.
Do you see yourself as a powerful person?
Thank you. I mean, I think like everyone, I vacillate. You know, it's funny because when you started this whole interview and you said, you know, you are like, you said something about like sort of my hopefulness or my positivity, yeah. You're positive. I think that is something that ever since I was a little kid, I was fascinated with this concept of optimism versus pessimism. And I remember speaking to my mother as a kid and saying, what is that? A pessimistic thing, I couldn't pronounce it, but I really was like so interested in understanding what is this dynamic between these two opposing kind of polarizing forces, right? The glass half empty, the glass half full. And I think, you know, with power, I think it's a choice that we have to make over and over again to feel powerful. I certainly don't always feel powerful. I feel, you know, many times I feel like I don't have power. But I think that it's almost like it, defying sort of the logic of a situation, you have to choose to feel powerful. You have to choose to show up in your power. And that then will impact actually your having power.
I love that. What did you want to do when you were a kid? You mentioned being a kid. And I think I know the answer because we've talked about this.
What do you think the answer is?
I think you said, and you with a straight face, I was going to be the president of the United States of America.
This is true. A little embarrassed to admit this, but yes, I definitely had a stage where I was like, absolutely, I want to be the president. I don't think I realized kind of what that meant when I said that. But I was very interested politically as a young child. And I credit my parents for that because when I was in fifth grade, and I have a fifth grader now. So I think about it. I was very young. I was, you know, maybe 10 years old at the time. I went to DC on a mission with NORPAC, which is a political action committee. And I was the only child on the bus. The bus was full of adults.
How did you get involved with NORPAC?
My dad was involved. He was a vice president of NORPAC at the time. And so, you know, they would have political candidates and figures, you know, in our house at times, and they were organizing a mission. And I don't know if I asked to go or if they said, do you want to come? But somehow I ended up on the bus. And it was such an incredible, empowering day because for the first time, I got to walk through the just, you know, cavernous, like beautiful halls of Congress and sit down with our legal representatives, you know, congressional leaders and leaders of the House. And I remember thinking, wow, like I'm sitting across a small table from this person who can literally shape our reality and advocate for what's important.
Very insightful fifth grader, which is also what, like your fifth grader daughter is very insightful. So I can see where she gets it.
Thank you. And I remember speaking about the importance of a strong Israel-American relationship and why. And, you know, so I was in fifth grade, but that was really exciting for me to say. And I think that was probably the point where I was like, I want to go into politics.
And like every person who wants to go into politics in the United States of America, you then went to an Ivy League school.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Where did you go? Why did you choose the place you went to?
That's a good question. I think it was chosen for me in some ways. Mm-hmm. But I also drank the Kool-Aid. So my family, you probably know this. My family is the longest line of legacy at Barnard College.
Longest line of Jewish legacy or longest line of legacy period?
Legacy period. Which is...
What does that mean for people that may not know what legacy means?
So legacy is essentially the idea that your descendants straight up the line have attended a specific, you know, school.
So you went to Barnard?
So I went to Barnard.
Which is a college in Columbia University.
It's the women's college within Columbia University.
Your mother?
My mother went to Barnard. My grandmother went to Barnard. My great aunt, who was kind of a generation older than my grandmother, went to Barnard. And my great grandmother went to Barnard.
She was the first.
She was one of the first Jews to graduate from Barnard. She graduated in 1915. And she was one of, I think, three Jewish women in a class of 50.
I want to talk about that, but something when I first heard that story, your partner, your husband, David, said, because we were talking about Jewish genealogy and his family coming from Eastern Europe. He said, when my great-grandmother had to step outside the shed to go walk like 100 yards to the, you know, outside toilet, your grandmother was one of the first Jews to be studying at one of the best schools in the world.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It gives you like the time, the idea. What does it mean to be a woman, a Jewish woman at Barnard in 1912, 13, 14, 15, yeah.
And she was actually, I think, I can't remember exactly how many kids were in the family, but there were many, like over 10. And I think she was the only, and many brothers, she was the only child to go to college. And all of her brothers rallied behind her to advocate for her parents to send her to Barnard.
So growing up, what was Barnard for you? What was Columbia University for you?
I mean, it was my family. It was my history. So much so that as a student at Barnard, I chose to do a thesis project about my family's legacy and the history of my family's legacy at Barnard. And then it grew from there into the history of Barnard and the relevance of a women's college today when obviously, you know, women have many options and it's not a necessity to go to a women's college. And I actually remember, and this was quite sort of a profound moment for me, when I went to Barnard for, I guess, a student, like a pre-tour interview. This was before I was accepted as a high school student. I walked into the student center and the first thing I see is this huge poster, framed photograph, black and white photograph. And it's like taking up, you know, half the wall. And it's my great grandmother sitting there with a group of her friends dressed in like this beautiful pinafore with her hair in a bun, sipping from a china teacup on the steps of Milbank. And I was like, I know this photograph. I've seen this photograph in my grandmother's albums. This is incredible. And what it meant to be a Jewish woman, you know, obviously, like we spoke about, actually getting a higher education at that time, not as a Jewish woman, as a woman in general, right? Yeah. It's very special.
Do you remember how you felt when you got the admittance letter? Back then it wasn't even emails. It was an actual envelope. Is it a thick envelope or a thin envelope? You got the thick envelope?
It was a thick envelope, I guess. Yeah, it was a thick envelope.
How did you remember?
I was ecstatic. I don't remember where I was, although I do remember actually. Yeah, I was in Israel studying for my gap year between high school and college. I had the privilege of, spending a year there. It was the first time I'd lived in Israel. And it was certainly the first time I'd lived alone. And it was an incredible experience. But it was also a very stressful experience.
What year was this?
It was 2000, 2001. So this was really the turning point in terms of the Second Intifada starting. And I remember what a stark contrast it was of what it felt like to be there in the beginning of September, just starting, you know, in this new school and living alone in this beautiful country and being so happy to be there and like the freedom of that. And then the Second Intifada starting. And all of a sudden, it was like the traps went down and I wasn't taking buses anymore. I wasn't going to the Shuk anymore. I wasn't going to malls anymore. I was going to cafes, but only certain cafes. I mean, the logic of it was kind of astounding, but also just I felt like I had to stay in my own safety and as much as I could. And I was terrified.
You know, the word intifada in the past 14 months have become really, you know, people use it to their own to their own means and their own goals, and, you know, changing the word. What comes to mind when you think intifada?
I know that the technical meaning is...
No. What comes to your mind?
For me?
Yeah.
Home, like terrorism in your home. It's the feeling of insecurity in your whereabouts, in going about doing your normal, you know, life activities because you are terrified of a bus blowing up in front of you or somebody stabbing you in the streets in the back or, you know, sitting in a cafe and somebody walking in with a chefetz chashud and the whole place, you know, erupting. And that was happening. I mean, I actually, until like this past time I was in Israel, every time I would go back and a bus would pass me by, I would catch myself holding my breath.
In Israel, when I drive and you're in gridlock and the bus next to you, I get nervous.
Yeah.
I for me, intifada is I know what the skeleton of a bus looks like.
Yeah.
Because it's the one thing that doesn't explode.
Correct.
And so you got to Barnard.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I stayed in Israel. My parents obviously gave me the option to come home, but I didn't want to. And I'm so glad I stayed. But it was definitely my first kind of experience with, I would say, real trauma. And then I came back and I went to Barnard and I loved college. I loved my experience at Barnard. In a way, I felt like it was kind of easy compared to high school, to be honest. And I felt like I had a lot of passions and interests outside of my academic, workload, which somehow I was able to juggle and still do very, very well. And, I loved college.
And then you get involved in this project that eventually comes to be known and titled Columbia Unbecoming.
Yes, yes.
What's that? What is Columbia Unbecoming?
So Columbia Unbecoming is a 2004 documentary.
When did you graduate?
2005.
Okay.
So I don't know how many people know kind of the history of this, but I'm sure we spoke about it a little bit, probably not fully, but essentially... Not on camera. It was not meant to be a documentary. It was not meant to be a public documentary. The genesis of Columbia Unbecoming was essentially... I was the student president of the Pro-Israel group on campus.
What was it called at the time?
Lion Pack. And because of my position of leadership, students were coming to me and to the group with experiences and grievances that they had, you know, had in specifically in Middle East studies classrooms because they were Jewish or Israeli, because they weren't towing the line politically with their professors. And so here were these stories of abuse or intimidation or grade manipulation. And they would say, like, what do we do with this? This is crazy. And so we would say, you know, go to the ombuds office. And the ombuds office would then say, go to the department chair. And the department chair would say, go to the professor. And it was this loop, this runaround.
And this was back in like 2003, 2004, yeah. Not 2024.
No. I was an undergrad. And I think that we naively thought the administration does not know about this issue. Obviously, if they knew about it, they would be doing something about this. This is abusive. This is not, you know, what a professor should be doing to students in a classroom.
What kind of things, just so people have some color?
So, I mean, it ranged from a professor, you know, for instance, asking an Israeli student, how many Palestinians have you killed in front of the whole class, to another professor telling a Jewish student, you're not a real Semite, you have green eyes, to a student who was like a straight-A student, all of a sudden getting D's. So, there are many more stories, but... You know, so it kind of ranged from making a student a target, intimidating a student in the classroom, to really kind of bullying. And obviously, if you are a student who wants to study the Middle East, you have to take classes in this department. And if you want to major in this because you want to pursue it potentially after, you know, your undergraduate, you need professors' recommendations. And so it becomes this system where you are stuck and you need to get good grades. You need the professorial recommendations. But you are being abused because you of your identity or because of your, you know, pushing back on the professors, what they're teaching in the classroom, maybe proposing an alternate perspective.
Were people experiencing it in any other topic?
Well,
in other classes at Barnard, other departments?
I would say that really primarily the students that were kind of voicing this and like their concerns and saying, you know, this is happening, I don't know what to do with this. It was really kind of centralized at that point to the Middle East Studies Department. Barnard did not have a Middle East Studies Department. So anyone who was taking classes in the Middle East was going to Columbia to do so.
Were any non-Jewish students experiencing this?
I'm not sure. The students that we spoke with were all Jewish, some Israeli, but probably. But by virtue of kind of why they were coming to me or to, you know, my peers in this Lion Pack group, these were Jewish students. Uh-huh. So anyway, I think one of my, you know, one of my friends said, well, let's put this, you know, let's document this on paper. Let's get them to write their testimonials down and we'll show the administration. And I intuitively knew back then that it would go right through a shredder and that we needed to put this on film. But it wasn't.
And you were a film student.
I was an English major. Uh-huh. I think I was just beginning to study film. Mm-hmm. I did not know I wanted to be a filmmaker at this point. This was kind of just maybe all coalescing. You know, I was getting involved in the film group on campus as well and starting to take film classes. But it maybe that was the lens that kind of I was bringing into it. But I also just thought, no, they need to see this. They need to see these students and hear it from them directly, yeah, as opposed to reading somebody's account on paper. And I also just felt like there was something about paper that it really would. It would just get buried. It would go through a shredder. And so that was how we ended up making this. Just to document, we brought in support from an outside organization called the David Project. They came on and they really kind of took the reins to help make this a reality. I organized the students. You know, we had I don't remember if it was 2 days of shooting where most of the students were willing to appear on camera. Some needed to mask their voices or their faces because they were fearful of retribution. And then we screened it for the administration in the spring. And they said nothing. It was the president at the time, President Bollinger, and the provost.
Tell me about this. So paint a picture for me. Where did you screen this? Were you present?
I was not present for that screening. Mm-hmm. Some of my colleagues were, or my fellow students were, and they watched it and they said nothing. And it was like, we'll get back to you. It was stone-faced. I actually then screened it for the president of Barnard because I was very close with her. And I was in the room while she watched that and I saw her emote and I saw her care. And it was actually like the opposite of the kind of response from what I heard in terms of Columbia's side of things. And she said, well, if this is actually happening, this is of grave concern. And she took it seriously. So meanwhile, the Columbia president, we got no response. Summer comes, you know, everyone's out, obviously. We resume in the fall. And the president of Barnard in the fall went to a federation conference, Lion of Judah conference.
Jewish Federation.
And I think she didn't realize that it wasn't like a public thing. She spoke about the film and there was press in the room. And that's how it kind of got leaked. The press started writing about it as this underground film exposing anti-Semitism at Columbia. And this is 2004. And at that point, myself and a few other students who were really active with, you know, kind of wielding the film, we realized we had to have a student screening, we had to have a press screening, and we had to represent the film publicly and frame it, you know, as we wanted, because we didn't want to lose the messaging around it. And it's so interesting because, you know, I think so much has changed, and obviously we have a lot to unpack here, obviously, with what I'm doing now. But at the time, we were not willing to say what's happening in the classroom is anti-Semitism.
I was going to say, there's one word that does not show up in this 40-something yes. odd yes. minute film that you can actually watch yes. on YouTube if you just Google Columbia Unbecoming. And that word is anti-Semitism. You're skirting around the issue.
Yep.
You are implying it, but something is stopping everyone yeah. that is being interviewed of saying the word anti-Semitism. Why is that?
Well, it's such a good question. I think there's multiple reasons. I think there's a pragmatic reason whereby we felt that we would get further, we would get more receptiveness towards this if we framed it through a more universal lens of academic abuse or academic freedom. And there was a sincerity around the idea that if this is happening to any student, you specifically asked me, right? Yeah. Like, was this happening to other students?
I was trying to understand if this...
And we set up, actually, in the wake of this film going public, we set up an organization on student, you know, on campus called Columbians for Academic Freedom. Myself and three other students, Ariel Beery, Aaron Horowitz, and Barry Weiss. And the four of us led the front on kind of this movement, so to speak, that erupted out of this film's going public in trying to affect change on campus.
And this is Barry Weiss from the Free Press.
Free Press, yes.
You said that if you don't use the word anti-Semitism, it would go further, right. It would be more effective.
So I think that was...
What was your reaction when it didn't?
I think another strong reason was some of us didn't want to admit that it was anti-Semitism. I think that was too scary.
Did you want to admit?
You know, I think this is an example of where kind of the heart and the mind are like this. Because I think in my heart, I knew that it was, but in my mind, I was intellectualizing it that it wasn't.
And looking back?
To me, it's very obvious, right? I think a lot of people post October 7th realize, why were we, you know, doing backbends and mincing words to try and avoid or, you know, kind of maneuver ourselves around this problem? Because we were raised in such a kind of very short-lived, fertile period of never again, right? Of this, like, post-Holocaust. We are beyond that. And this didn't immediately look like that. This was something else. But at the end of the day, obviously, like, a post-October 7th world, we realize, well, actually, it's just rebranded itself.
There are many ways that Columbia didn't do anything about the film, if my understanding. And the film even made it to the media.
They did the bare minimum.
The bare minimum. But one...
They did, by the way, after the film screened publicly, within, I want to say, like 12 hours, we got... emails were very concerned. You know, this is after months of silence. We take this seriously. We are concerned about these issues. We want to meet with you. It was the first time they requested a meeting.
I'm still waiting for a meeting with Columbia University, so it takes a while. So if you go and you watch a movie, and I really recommend everyone take the time on YouTube and watch it. First of all, it's clear that most of the Jewish kids that are being targeted, they're Israeli. So it's visible through their accent, or they are more on the observant, visibly Jewish. They are wearing yarmulkes, they are wearing skirts or dresses.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. But the other thing, one of the people in that film, the professors that is being complained about, is someone that many people may have heard their name in the past 14 months, The president of Colombia, the past president of Colombia, was asked about specifically about this person in Congress, in her testimony, Joseph Massad. Mm-hmm. Who is Joseph Massad?
You could probably articulate this better than I could. Joseph Massad is a professor, now a tenured professor at Columbia. He happens to be the professor that is the only professor in the Middle East Studies department that is teaching Zionism. He, at the time when Columbia Unbecoming was made, was not tenured. He did not have that rank, and he was seen as kind of like controversial and not very respected academically. I don't think we thought it was like even a possibility this person would be tenured at the time.
And this is the professor of it back then already. There's a very, it's comic, but it's also scary. There's a student, an Israeli student, I think, in the film, where Joseph Massad tells the class that Zionism, Zion, comes from the word Zion, which is penis.
Yes.
And why it's all dirty. And of course, and the Israeli student says, every person with even a cursory knowledge of Hebrew knows that Zion or Zionism in Hebrew is Tzion, but sounds different, is completely different.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it's so funny and ridiculous, but a professor at an Ivy League school would make such a stupid mistake, but it's not a mistake. He knows what he's doing. But it's scary.
Yeah. No, he's also the professor that obviously post October 7th called the October 7th massacre amazing.
He said that he experienced jubilation and awe.
Right.
But do you remember when you found out that he got tenure?
Yeah.
After the movie came out.
Yeah.
He actually got denied the tenure the first time. And then President Bollinger made a specific attempt to get him tenure again. The person on his tenure committee quit because they saw all the wrongdoing. But he ended up getting tenure at a second chance. Do you remember learning about this, how you felt?
I do. No, it was very depressing. I after I graduated, I, you know, kind of like moved away from the campus activist hat that I was wearing. And I, you know, started making films and documentaries. And I moved to LA and I worked for a big film producer out there. And I really kind of lost touch a little bit with Columbia. But I obviously did hear that he got tenured, and it was upsetting, very upsetting and demoralizing, right? Because I worked so hard with these other students and spent so much of my, you know, junior and senior year at Columbia devoted to creating change, to trying to really not just create a system where students could like legitimately and reliably, you know, lodge grievances, where that would be heard, where that would be dealt with judiciously, but also where professors who were clearly misstepping, you know, in terms of the bounds of what is normal academically, targeting students, etc., where that wasn't tolerated. And it felt very demoralizing because it felt like, for what? Right? What's actually changed here?
So what do you think? Why did Barnard and Columbia not listen? Why did they grant this anti-Semite?
Yeah. So this is, you know, something that I've been kind of diving into for the past year, in, as obviously you're well aware, but the listeners might not be, making a follow-up of sorts, a documentary called Poison Ivies, that is really taking a deep dive into what's happened at Columbia over the last year, but then really zooming out to understand, well, how did we get here? This is not a problem that was born overnight. Clearly, as somebody who made this, you know, Columbia Unbecoming 20 years ago, I saw a problem and the writing on the wall back then. I didn't know how bad it would get, but I also didn't know I knew that this wasn't something that, you know, was unique to my fellow peers. I knew from making Columbia Unbecoming and hearing then, once this came out, from graduates who, you know, had been there years earlier, maybe decades earlier, saying, wow, thank you. Like, this happened to me. And, you know, nobody's ever spoken out about it. It's, you know, that kind of thing where there's a whistleblower, essentially. That's when stories start to emerge out of the woodwork. And so I knew it wasn't a new problem. And I've been working, you know, over the last year to document that. And I think it's hard because there's many reasons, but ultimately, like, the analogy we always used was sort of like when you try and turn an ocean liner around, it's like very challenging, right? It's like you need to continue to exert pressure. Like, you kind of exert pressure and it goes like this. And then the second you ease up, it's like, goes right back. So I think
very interesting analogy. I served 3 years in the Israeli Navy.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of maritime rules on who gets the right of way, da 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 da. But it basically boils down to the bigger you are, the more right of way you have. You know, if you are the small boat, so you have to skirt around. Yep. Columbia is the big boat, they can just keep going. And, you know, until a bigger boat comes and says, no, Columbia, you know, move out of the way.
Yes. And the big boat is comprised of big people in the big boat who hold power, right? Tenure was created probably with very good reasons, right, in terms of protecting professors who weren't towing the line, who were, like, thinking individually, potentially outside of the mainstream. But it's gotten to a point, I think, where it's abusive. It's problematic because there are no checks and balances.
I believe this is not hyperbole. Like, I believe that a tenured professor can show up at Columbia University with a Hamas headband, a swastika, Heil Hitler, and say, long live Hamas, long live the Intifada, in class. And maybe there will be an email to the community. Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when we, at the end of the whole Columbia Unbecoming thing, there was a slap on the wrist to two professors, one of whom I think was sent on paid leave for a semester till things quieted down and then brought right back.
By the way, that's what they offered me. They offered me paid leave to just go and don't teach, and we'll give you money, we'll give you course credit. And I said, no. I want to be in the classroom because I'm a professor.
Yeah, they're very good at that kind of stopgap solution. They're good at the let's hire the, you know, big PR firms in the city. Let's try and make the noise go away. Let's not actually address the systemic problems.
So what have you learned making this follow-up movie, Poison Ivy's? I still believe it should be called Columbia Still Unbecoming.
Yeah.
Or Columbia Unbecoming with a Vengeance. But...
What
have you learned? And you've interviewed, if I'm not mistaken, professors, students, administrators, experts on education, experts on anti-Semitism, Jewish and non-Jewish.
It's a great question. I've learned that you and your wife are incredible people. Really.
What have you learned about Columbia?
I mean, it's sad. I've learned that, you know, students are hurting. Like, I actually, this made me so upset. I heard about this event that, I don't know if I should say this. So, a Jewish group of kind of philanthropists and engaged community members hosted Rashid Khalidi, who recently retired from Columbia, but sat in the Edward Said, you know, position chair, very esteemed.
One of the things about, there's many things about Rashid Khalidi. I always say, you know, all you need to know about Rashid Khalidi is go on Google and write Rashid Khalidi PLO spokesperson. And you'll find everything you need to know. But another thing is, he gave a retirement interview. I think it was The Guardian. And I think the quote was something like, I don't mind being called a terrorist or something like that.
Sure.
Not only would I mind being called a terrorist, I can't even imagine why someone would call me anything even close. If you are comfortable with that, that means you've made some wrong decisions in your life.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. So this group hosted him. I think they wanted to understand his perspective. They wanted a different perspective on what was happening at the university. I'm not exactly sure the backstory, but I do know that there was a set of rules, essentially, that they had to agree to in order for him to accept this invitation. One of which was there are no spontaneous questions, there is no interruptions, and like there's no alternative opinions. So
have you ever seen me give a talk? It's the exact
opposite. That's actually a good question.
I don't think you've seen me give a talk.
Well, I mean, obviously spontaneously at school.
Give. It's all about questions, conversations. You can record everything because that is academic freedom. That is the whole point of a conversation.
Exactly. And that is the Jewish way.
But Rashid Khalidi is not Jewish and he's not a professor. He's an indoctrinator. He wants to indoctrinate. Indoctrination requires you listen and not speak.
Passively, exactly. With your hands tied behind your back and your mouth zipped.
Yeah.
You said he's not a Jewish professor. That's the most upsetting thing to me about this. He had the gall, the lack of human decency to get up in front of this room of Jewish people and speak for the entire Jewish student body in saying, there's no anti-Semitism at Columbia. It's just noise. The students are whining.
This is the same. This is Rashid Khalidi who was recorded saying that, you know, Jews get indoctrinated in synagogues. Some of the people in that philanthropist group are affiliated with at least one synagogue that I know of in the Upper West Side.
Yes.
I actually never heard from this group, so obviously they think they know everything, so they don't need to hear from Shai Davidai, and that's fine, no ego there. But I don't blame Rashid Khalidi for showing up. If SJP invited me to come speak, whether there's issues with anti-Semitism or Islamophobia or whatever it is on campus, I would go. It's the people that invited him and gave him the microphone.
Absolutely. No, and I think you should go. But I know that what you wouldn't do is you wouldn't speak for any Muslim student on campus.
I don't even speak for the Jewish students. I speak for myself.
Right. And so the fact that he would profess to say, I can tell you, there's no Jewish students are not feeling that, is so horrific to me. It's like, how dare you? But anyway, so I do know that Jewish students are suffering. That was a kind of a...
No, you're
a side story, but I do know because I have spoken to so many students over the year who have unfortunately, been very psychologically affected by this last year, who have had to take classes on Zoom, or who have lost entire friend groups, who have had to switch out of certain classes because they couldn't handle the torture of it. Who have had, their great suffering because of the incessant banging of drums outside their window, during exams or whatnot, who are scared to walk through campus wearing a Magen David. I mean, just this week, there was a student who was punched for being Jewish on the street.
Well, he was punched for being Jewish, who's unwilling to renounce his relationship to the idea of a Jewish state.
Sure. Well,
there are
Jewish
students that happily, lick the boots of the SJPers and say, Israel is horrible. I am no longer this. I am just Jewish. And they don't get.
But we both know that does not represent the majority of Jews. Right. And especially, obviously Jewish students on campus, there's a huge population of Jewish students who are Zionist, who believe in Israel's right to exist, who, don't prescribe to the JVP.
And again, just like with Columbia Unbecoming, this is an observation because you've had hours upon hours with students.
Yeah.
I feel like the vast majority of the students that are being targeted on campus by their peers, by staff, by professors, are from what we would call modern Orthodox.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily?
No.
That's good.
No. I mean, I just spoke to a student the other week who... I don't know. I think I mentioned this to you. She was not at all affiliated, and so much so that I feel like, she was kind of She didn't even have a single Jewish friend until she was forced to find new friends, because after October 7th, she posted on her social media, Jewish lives matter too. And we should end all bloodshed in the Levant. And then swiftly, she got canceled.
For what is objectionable in saying Jewish lives matter too, not Jewish lives matter, Jewish mm-hmm. lives matter too, mm-hmm. and we should all stop all bloodshed in the Levant?
Beats me.
I mean, what did her friends tell her? What was the feedback?
They said, you are a Zionist.
And what did she
we
say?
We can't be friends with a Zionist. It is this, it, and by the way, she was like, I don't even know what a Zionist is. Like, I don't think I'm a Zionist. And then she did her research and she was like very skeptical about what it meant to be a Zionist. And at first she was like, no, I.
So how, what in her statement shows Zionism? Like you cannot be a Zionist and say Jewish lives matter too. All bloodshed should be stopped.
That was not tolerant. Because she wasn't just free Palestining, like from the river to the sea, she was therefore canceled. Like it was too much for her to say Jewish lives matter too, and let's end all bloodshed. I mean, she was very careful with her words, obviously, but that was too much. It was like too much pushback. And this is days after October 7th. This is before, by the way, you know, Israel went into Gaza.
What about administrators and other professors?
I think there's a spectrum in terms of professors, you know, who are obviously from one extreme, you clearly risking everything to speak the truth to power, to be an advocate for students, to call out, you know, what you're seeing, and to be so, you know, ethically aligned with your values that you're willing to suffer the consequences. And then I think there's, you know, obviously many professors who aren't as brave, or who willfully don't want to see just how bad it has gotten because it's too threatening to their identity. And
that's the point that I want to, maybe you can elaborate more.
Yeah.
Why do they not want to see? Or is it really, because, you know, let's be fair. If they were here, they would say, no. I think you are hypersensitive. You are searching for it. It's not really there. Maybe there's a speck and you're magnifying the speck.
Yeah. I think that when so much of your identity and your success and your professional career is wrapped up with an institution, it's very hard to acknowledge the problems of that institution when they are so systemic. That's not to say that there aren't moments, right, where students have like great experiences at Columbia still. Obviously, it's not like all bad all the time, but it is systemically rotten. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you and I know this. Like, there's so many things that have pointed to it over the last year and obviously over the last decades. But when you're so close to it, it's hard to see it. And I think it's also threatening to the ego, to the self, to the sense of self. And so, you know, it's hard for me. Like, we were talking about my family's legacy at Barnard, right? I love Columbia. I want to send my daughters there. I would hate to break that chain. I am sitting here calling out the problems because I want it to get better, because I believe that it has to get better, that I believe that, you know, Jewish students cannot just retreat from the places that don't want them or that are not treating them fairly. And also because I believe that, like, the bigger problem is one that affects every person in this country, every person who believes in democracy and freedom, essentially. And I think that Columbia is obviously not unique in terms of it's not the only, but it is certainly a beacon on a hill, right? It is certainly looked upon as an example, as an exemplary example. And so I think it's really complicated.
I've been thinking about this beacon on the hill, the exemplary idea. Colombia really and really dropped the ball on this, and still they can do something. Imagine if Colombia would have created itself as the school that's dealing with anti-Jewish, anti-Israel, and anti-Americanism. The school that is willing to question everything in order to rid the school of hate and bolster education and democracy. Yeah. Like, what would have been the reaction around the country and around the world? Colombia could have become the brand of 15 million Jews, Israelis, and in the diaspora applying, saying like, this is going to be a great institution again, rather than caring about, are we ranked number 3 or number 4 in the world 500 universities?
Yeah.
Imagine if that would have happened.
Yeah, yeah. I'm hoping that it still can. Maybe that's where my optimistic, right?
So hopeful. And this, your optimism is kind of interesting, because over the past year, other than my wife, Jordan, you are the person with whom I've talked most about all of this. I don't know how many times I sat in front of your camera. It must have been probably 4, 5, 6 times more, 7, you know, an hour or two at a time. You have hours and hours going back, I think, November or December 2023 to before being banned the first time, being banned, the encampments, the imam, everything. Like, sometimes I feel like I am even too close. And because I'm trying to push the wall away, I have to be next to the wall. But you have been there. You have been an observer throughout this time. And it's weird that I ask this. I wasn't planning to ask this, but why have things happened the way that they have? And did you know when we started that my role in this would be the role that it is?
No, I'm not a fortune. I'm not a prophetess. I definitely did not know that. I saw, obviously, like many people, I don't know how many views you've had on that initial video, but millions, I mean, hundreds of thousands,
15 million, I think.
Yeah. Millions. I saw somebody whose heart was cracked open, who was willing to say the things that most people couldn't articulate, from such a deep place of concern and care and fear and I think that that's rare to see from a professor, honestly, because there's so many reasons not to put yourself in that position. There's so many good reasons to put your head down, to just keep doing, you know, your thing, to wear the hat that you were, you know, put in that community to wear. And whether knowingly or unknowingly, you know, you understood what that meant when you, you know, had people take out their phones and film you.
I had no idea.
You really did something so brave. And I think through doing that, you unleashed kind of or opened the floodgates for students to feel validated in their feelings. And I did not know, because again, like, I'm hopeful. Like, I was so hopeful that the university would meet you physically, like literally and metaphorically. Like, I really believe that they would do so much better than they did. I think it was shocking to the world, and it was certainly shocking to me, just how badly it was mismanaged over and over and over again.
And still is.
And still is. I mean, it's a Band-Aid. It's like they've literally locked the gates. Just, you know, nobody in, and then you won't see what's happening. So no, there's definitely no, like, I know where this is going. I know that this guy is going to, this is going to, but I feel very privileged to have been literally in your corner over the last year to witness it.
I am so grateful for you being in my corner. And honestly, one of the things that I don't sleep well at night. I haven't slept well since October 7th. But one of the things that helped me is knowing that whatever happens to me or anyone else, somewhere there's a recorded archive of at least my side of the story.
Yeah.
And I never argue, I'm not a Rashid Khalidi. I don't think there is just one side to the story.
No, there never is.
But I do want to make sure that my side of the story, and by the way, in this point, I think it's our, you and I have been in this for so long together, that it's our part of the story. And I don't know what's going to happen with that. So where is the movie going?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, I think that the beauty of documentaries is that you don't know where they're going when you start. You know, you might have a good idea in terms of, okay, this is the story I am looking to tell. This is definitely the subject matter. These are the characters. But until you're sitting with the footage in the edit room, you don't really know where it's going. And that's kind of just the incredible, you know, spontaneity of it. It's like you don't have that fully baked, proven, you know, recipe. And you also want to allow for life to happen, of course. And so, you know, I didn't know where the story was going exactly. I thought at first I'd be wrapped on shooting at the end of last semester in the spring, right? Mm-hmm. It was like kind of the academic calendar year.
Right. We were talking about this might be, I think it was June, we were doing this is might be the last interview. What have we learned, et cetera. Right?
Exactly. And then I realized, no, like we have to see what happens when campus resumes and like what that feels like. And I think that there's still pieces to get in terms of student stories, in terms of certainly the fact that Masad is teaching Zionism next semester. And I mean, I think it's like outrageous that there isn't another alternative perspective, right, being taught. And then wanting to tell kind of this wider story of, well, where did this come from? And how has Hamas been planning this for decades? And how have like all these different pieces in terms of, you know, how has this generation kind of primed itself to be the generation where they're being kind of honestly victimized by this like type of indoctrination and polarized by it? And, you know, where like this paradigm of oppressed and oppressor has just sort of taken root through every lens, every, you know, discipline. I was speaking to a student the other day and I could not believe she recounted how in her student orientation, I remember my student orientation certainly didn't have this exercise. They had to go around the room. And these are students who are obviously all nervous, imposter syndrome, you know, anxious to make new friends and wondering whether they're, you know, deserving to be in the room. And they have to say whether they're the oppressed or the oppressor. They have to label themselves. I mean, how?
Who would label themselves an oppressor? You know what? Who would label themselves an oppressed? I'm not oppressed. I'm not an oppressor. I'm shy. What? I don't understand this.
Yeah, this is literally what they had to do. And I mean, it's like, to me, it's worse than counterproductive.
How is this different than if I take all my students and I say, all right, line up from the parent who makes the most money to the parent that makes the least money, or line up from the darkest skin to the lightest skin. I want to know who's the whitest person here. Line up from, you know, the straightest to the gay. Like, I don't understand this.
Yeah. No, I mean, what they're saying is,
what is being taught?
This is the pair of glasses that you need to survive this experience. That you need to be accepted in this experience.
But what's the educational purpose or the social purpose?
I mean, I think it's like to teach this dogma, this, you know, this is the lens through which you will understand everything you are reading, through which you will process everything you are learning here. So, you know, whether it's you are white and you are, you know, the oppressor because you are the colonizer, because, you know, you have privilege, blah, 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 or whether you are brown skinned and you are therefore the victim here. It's just like this very flat, very lacking of humanity type of paradigm that obviously is one lens, but it certainly shouldn't be the only lens. And I think that is the problem. Like I hear from students about whether it's a literature class or, you know, so a humanities class or a political theory class, or it cycles through each one of these classes. And if they dare kind of voice an alternative perspective, they are being called out as an oppressor, or, you know, you don't have the right to that.
Even if it has nothing to do with Israel.
Correct. Nothing to do with Israel. Mm-mm. Yeah.
So you've met a lot of students in the past year. You've been on campus quite a few times. You're showing pride and love and humanity through other stuff. So what is Atouf? A-T-O-O-F.
You know, I think I started, what kind of Jew are you? I said multifaceted, right? And I think that for me, Judaism is so much about kind of the duality of things, the multiplicity of things. So I was raised observant. I've always been observant, and obviously very engaged in Jewish ritual and spirituality. But at the same time, I've always appreciated nice things and the aesthetic. And I have a very, you know, keen eye. I'm a filmmaker. I'm an artist. I'm a designer. And so there was a clear missing gap for me, I realized, actually, around Judaica, which are, you know, any object pertaining to a Jewish ritual. This kind of dawned on me after my husband lost his tallit bag that I had gifted him at our wedding. And I was looking for a replacement, and I just couldn't find anything really special. And that was kind of the dawning of Atouf, a very long, this is like 8 years ago now. But essentially, Atouf is a luxury artisanal Judaica company. My co-founder is one of my best friends. We've known each other since our year in Israel, actually. And we seek to really bring Jewish people together around pride for their Jewish culture and tradition and ritual. You know, so often I think people assume, oh, rituals are just for the observant. And I think one of the things about Atouf is we want to share it with everybody. We want everybody to feel connected. And when you value something, when you put value into it, when you, you know, kind of use things that are beautiful, you tend to actually appreciate them more.
So what kind of things, what kind of Judaica do
you... So everything is handcrafted. We found these incredible artisans in Mumbai that do anything textile. So we launched with tallit and tefillin bags. We then added challah covers, a matzah afikomen set. We just recently launched mezuzot and art. And we're also about to launch jewelry, fine jewelry. So I'm actually wearing our first piece.
Can you describe it for people listening in?
Yeah, it's a khamsa, and it represents the dina. So each one of our pieces in our collection, each kind of the entire collection, represents the entirety of the Jewish people, because each one stems from one of the children of Jacob. And so we wanted to be inclusive, so we brought dina into it. So there are 13 different kind of collections. And dina was challenging because every one of the brothers, the sons, got a blessing from Jacob, from Yaakov, before Yaakov passed away. And that blessing would then become sort of the ethos or the characteristics of that tribe. Dina did not. And there's very little recorded of her in the Torah. And the one story that we do know about her is not a very positive one. Yeah. And so we kind of were, you know, wanting, and every one of the insignias or the motifs on these designs is very thoughtful and connected to the blessing, connected to the, you know, ethos of that brother or that son. And so with Dina, we wanted to do something that felt authentic to her. And so we came up with the Chamsa, because the Chamsa is a universal symbol of protection, a universal symbol that there is a higher power, that sometimes we don't understand why things happen to us in life, but ultimately there is some reason. It's not just chaos. And so the Chamsa, yeah, that's our first piece of jewelry. The Chamsa appears on the tallit and tefillin bag and on the challah cover, and now it's a...
Is the your Magen David ring?
This also is Rachi Schnee. This is the Mazel Club, another female Jewish founder.
Beautiful. Where can people find Atouf?
Atouf is online, atoufcollective.com.
A-T-O-O-F collective.com.
Yes. Atouf, which in Hebrew, as you know, means to envelop or to enwrap. We want people to feel held by these rituals.
Beautiful.
And then also on Instagram, atouf.co, A-T-O-O-F.co.
I don't know why I just got super emotional. I for some reason, I was thinking about my grandfather.
Say more.
Saba Benny. When he passed away, he sat down with my dad and kind of like told him like a sentence to write about every one of the grandchildren, and like me and my nine other cousins.
It was like what Yaakov did with his children before he passed.
And the sentence or whatever he said about me was that I'm passed away before when I was in graduate school. I'm going to be the first professor in the family. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at you and I'm thinking, like, maybe I've ruined it all and I will no longer be a professor by the time. I don't know.
No. You definitely didn't ruin it.
We'll see.
You have taken a kind of a unpredictable step.
Unpredictable path, yeah.
But you have not ruined anything. You are obviously doing...
We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, I'm not going to say more because you're going to edit this part out.
Yeah, exactly.
I know you.
So I like to finish every episode with what I call the Jewish lightning round, a series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer. We just want the first answer that comes to mind. Mm. Danielle Kahana, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Oh, okay. Well, this one's kind of fun. I don't know in what like stage of my career, but at some point, like my secret dream is to be on Dancing with the Stars.
Okay, let's get that going. Are you a dancer?
I love dancing.
Okay.
I love dancing.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
Huh. People know so much about the Jews. We really just want to be left alone.
What is your favorite curse? Any language.
Can I pass on this one?
But you don't get to pass on any else.
Oh, shoot.
I knew you would pass on this. It's okay. I know you. Yes. When was the last time you cried?
Oh, my God. Every day.
Every day?
I'm such a crier. I'm the person that cries at every movie. I took my kids to Wicked before Thanksgiving, and I'm sitting there during the – have you seen it? There's, you know, this dance scene. And I just started bawling, like heaving to the point where my girls, I think they're embarrassed. They're like, Mom, are you okay? Like, do you need tissue or something? You need to go out. I'm a big crier. And I think it's a catharsis. Like, I think it's so important to cry. For me, it's like moving that energy.
You make incredible Shabbat dinners. So if you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Well... I actually really want to say my great grandmother, because she's the person that I am named after. I actually wasn't named after her initially. I added a middle name as an adult and took on her name. She was my mother's partner. She called her mine partner, and my mother was so close to her. And I think I never had the privilege of knowing her. Whereas I was very lucky to have met many of my great-grandparents because my parents had me so young. And I really wish I had.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
I cannot pick one. I love them all. I would say Shavuot, just because my bat mitzvah was on Shavuot. And so it's like forever embedded with a very meaningful time of celebration and milestone in my life.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
I really love them all. I mean, I get a lot of dread around Tisha B'Av. Like, really. Like, I have so much anticipatory anxiety around Tisha B'Av, not just because it's a fast day and I'm a terrible faster, but because it really feels like a time of mourning for the Jewish people and everything that is weighing upon us, and all of the anti-Semitism and all of the Sinat Chinam, the hatred between us, and all of the things that, you know, kind of have been age-old struggles just pop. They just bubble kind up. Of like, yeah, they kind of get even cloudier. So I would say I can't wait for the day where that's not a thing anymore.
When do you feel safest?
Shabbat dinner, my family.
When do you feel least safe?
Columbia University, whenever I'm there. Whenever I'm there during a protest.
What gives you hope?
Our history.
What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the words Jewish civil rights?
You.
Oh, thank you. What's the second thing?
I mean, my kids go to Heschel, so Rabbi Heschel definitely stands out.
Yeah.
You know, the principles through which he lived and the teachings, and it's like sewn into the fabric of my kids' school, and I'm very grateful to be a part of that community.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Well, obviously, I have to plug the doc.
Let me plug the doc so you can put a charity in. So how can people help the documentary become a reality?
Thank you. I have a fiscal sponsor, so I am able to accept donations, and they can contact me. Daniela at riverside-pics.com.
Daniela at riverside-pics.
P-I-C-S.
P-I-C-S.com.
.com. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or get in touch with you. You know how to reach me.
I know.
Okay. There's so many important charities, obviously, and it's like, I don't know how to just pick one. I think that the one I will share, though, because I think they do such important work and have been specifically targeted. You mentioned, you know, obviously, you know, in the film or what appears to you on campus, the students that get targeted are so often the ones that are visibly, identifiably Jewish. And so I'm going to say Chabad, because I think that they, by the fact that they are choosing to live, you know, visible Jewish lives and also be a source, a resource and a shelter for Jews around the world, they make themselves targets. They are targets. And unfortunately, we've seen that play out way too much this year. And obviously, I can recount many examples in the past. But I think they do tremendous good in the world. And and so I think Chabad, nice. Donate to Chabad.
Where can people find you?
Where can people find me? I am on Instagram.
At?
Daniela Kahane.
K-A-H-A-N-E.
Yeah, my name. Atouf, I already mentioned.
A-T-O-O-F.co.
And the other hat that I know we've spoken about but didn't get much airtime today is I run a negotiation training company for women, and that's at Win Summit. So negotiation as a tool of empowerment.
Yeah. We haven't gotten to a lot of things. Before we end, I just want to tell you one thing. I don't think I ever told you this. We also have a lot of spiritual, theistic conversation. You as a very spiritual, strong believer, me as an atheist. We were spending time at your place over the weekend, over some weekend with my family, and we had a conversation. It was very interesting.
It was a very...
Nobody changed.
It was a very pivotal weekend.
Yeah, and that's what I want.
Yeah.
Nobody changed her mind, and that was not the point. The point was to sharing each other's mind rather than changing each other's minds. And then you basically said something that changed the way I think about belief. I'm still a bit an atheist. I'm not changing anything about myself because there's no need for me. But it was... We finished dinner, we were talking about belief and non-belief and how can you believe and how can you not believe. And when we find out that 6 hostages were executed, including Hirsch Goldberg Polin, and I asked you, do you remember what I asked you? I asked you, how can you believe in a time like this? And you said, how can I not believe in a time like this? And I think that gave me the clearest view into a believer's heart and mindset that no other articulation of logic and philosophy could have. So thank you. And thank you for coming
thank
today.
You for...
And I'm so, so happy we made this happen. So here I am with Daniela
Kahana.
Thank you
for everything you're doing for students, for Jews, for humanity. And thank you for being...
Thank you for being
dear
my friend. Thank you for being my friend.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."